So if you're here for the spring session of evolutionary psychology, great job, right place. If you're here for something else, well, talk to me about that and we'll see what we can do, all right? So I'm Dr. Snyder. I'll be teaching the course this term. Now, if you're registered in the course, you should have gotten an email from me to your ualberta.ca account last night, giving you the website information. No, we're not actually on Moodle or whatever at this point. So it's to get to the course site, you have to use the link that I sent you there in email, or you can jot this down and get there as well. On the website, you will find the syllabus. Faculty of Science has requested that we no longer give you paper syllabi. On the one hand, this is good for the environment. On the other hand, it saves the Faculty of Science a lot of money in terms of photocopying fees. So it's a sort of win-win there. And you can just go and look at it online as often as you desire. I'll give you the basic info here about the syllabus, but I do ask that you do take a read through it. There is some important stuff in there, and it's rather unfortunate sometimes when people go, "I didn't know that." And I come back with, it's like, well, it's in the syllabus. And you go, oh. So, you know, best to take a peek at that. Anyways, the syllabus is there, PDF file. Also on the course website, you'll find the PowerPoint lecture slides. The first six chapters we're going to be covering, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 9, are currently up there. So you can get those. I know some people like to print these out and take notes in the margins, or you want to check them afterwards, whatever, however it works for you. I give them to you. Computer here is recording the dulcet tones of my voice. Yeah, it's recording the audio of this. So while, so here's the deal. We've got someone who's out of town, has to miss a class. I mean, if you miss a 50-minute class during, you know, regular term, you miss 50 minutes of stuff, you miss a part of a chapter. You miss a three-hour class here in spring session, you're missing a significant chunk of the course, and you're missing probably an entire chapter's worth of material. So, in conjunction with the PowerPoint slides, you can also listen to the audio track of what I said during the lecture, if you have to miss something, and then you can come talk to me about any other questions you may have. Please don't take this as a, well, you got the PowerPoint slides, you got the audio, I don't need to bother coming to class. I've been doing this for a number of years. Here's my take on this. Some people can actually manage not to bother coming to class. The vast majority of people may think they can do this, but actually can't. This may be because it's not a problem, I'll make sure I listen to the podcasts. But we all know how well that's going to actually work, right? Finding another 6 hours a week to listen to the podcasts on top of whatever you're doing, the time you may not be. Okay, so look, my experience is that people that decide not to bother coming for the actual class sessions and just think they're going to listen to the podcast, most of them don't do as well as they could. I'm not saying they fail. I'm just saying they may not do as well as they could. So, if you are discovering by the point of the midterm, you know, for whatever reason, you're not doing as well as you think you should be, time to reassess and reevaluate. You're adults. I'm not forcing you to come to class. Okay? I do make this stuff available to you. So, just be advised. Take this at your own discretion. Okay? Enough on that. The assignment information is also up there on the course. The four very short, we'll talk about the details in a few minutes here, the four very short assignments are posted. The paper topics for the course are posted. So all of that information is up there as well. There's links and various other things on the website too. So take a peek at that. Hello. Take a peek at that if you have not already. Okay, well, this is me, Dr. Snyder. I've got an office over in the psych building, so it's on the second floor, which is the main floor, not the next floor up. If you go down to the first floor, which you think would be the main floor, it's actually the basement. It's the psychology wing. What do you expect? I mean, you know, we're messing with you. Of course we are. I mean, I'm not actually going to bother holding set office hours in spring session because past experience shows that generally people don't bother coming. So, I mean, I'm available after class. I don't have to be anywhere in particular, so you can catch me and talk to me after class. I'm usually here a bit before class. We'll have a 10-minute break in the middle of class. So, and if none of that is working for you, then you can get in touch with me and we can actually arrange a time that's going to work to meet outside of this period. So, anyways, I mean, odds are you will never actually have to go over to my office for anything. But should you care to go by, there it is. Phone number there, so there's the office phone. I will check that. Obviously, it has an answering machine on it. You may even catch me there during the day. I've got a very busy teaching schedule this term. I'm teaching three courses, one of which is actually a 300-400 level split. So I'm actually teaching the equivalent of about 3.5 courses, which equates to teaching about 7 courses during, well, let's say 6 courses during regular term. I usually teach 3 in regular term. So my teaching schedule is very, very busy, but still, we can try to, if you can't see me after class or da-da-da, we can arrange something there. There's the phone. It has an answering machine on it. If I'm not there, you can leave a message and do that. Email. I honestly don't like dealing trying to answer questions from students through email because I find it's often a lot more effective for both of us to just do this in person because we can actually ask questions back and forth really, really nicely. If you look at it this way, we're evolved to use spoken language in face-to-face communication. So that's tapping. We'll talk evolutionary psychology. We'll talk about that. That's tapping into this, you know, language module, the way that we've evolved to do this. We didn't evolve to email. It's a very crude form of communication by comparison. But still, if you do wish to email me something, I'm back now and checking the email. So put psycho, P-S-Y-C-O, 302, into the subject line. That routes it to the course mailbox. I get a stunning amount of spam. Something like 85% of what I get is just crap. So I've got pretty extreme spam blockers on there. If you don't put that, it won't get routed to the course website. The course email box. I may or may not spot it before it gets dumped into trash. Hard to say, but that does it. Please do use your at ualberta.ca account. I have never had problems. It's not entirely true. I once had a problem, but that was exceptional. That's when the entire university's mainframe was hacked and went down for 2.5 days. Other than that, I've never had a problem either receiving or sending email to the at ualberta.ca accounts. I have had difficulties both receiving and sending to pretty much every other email account system on the face of the planet. So use that one. Please put your name and ID number in any messages. And, you know, if don't expect that you're necessarily going to get a reply minutes after you send your email in. This may take a couple of business days to handle. If you don't get something back from me, then catch me in class. resend the email, see me at class, phone, write a note, tie it to, a pigeon. If it's not a trained pigeon, I'm not going to get the message. But if you've taken 281 with me, you can train the pigeon and, use a little picture of me as a controlling stimulus. And, every time the pigeon sees me, you give it some grain and it'll find it. Okay. The other thing is Skype. If I'm sitting in front of a computer that's actually got a decent internet connection, I'll just flip my Skype account on. So, if you got nothing else to do or you want to try to do it that way, if you're on Skype as well, Skype to Skype is free. So, woohoo, you can check me that way. So it's Michael R. Snyder. Any idea how many Michael Snyders there are in the world? Apparently the best I could have for Michael Snyder was Michael Snyder number 136. So it's like, okay. So Michael R. Snyder. Already mentioned the office hour stuff there. Okay, so there's that. Textbook, It's over in the bookstore? Yeah. Okay, good. So Workman and Reader, I think it's from 2008. Evolutionary Psychology, an Introduction. Not a stunningly, exciting title. You'd think it could be something like Evolutionary Psychology. Wow! Stuff that will change your life. But it's from Cambridge University Press, so they're a little more... Okay, anyways. We'll be doing about a chapter a week. Yeah, a take. I mean, there'll be some overlap and whatnot, but roughly a chapter a week here. Here's how the evaluation breaks down. There's a midterm exam on the 2nd of June. Chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 9, and lectures. Final exam. I've got this in here. I've got to check this. On the syllabus, it's listed as TBA. I think this may be correct. I think it's June 17th, 3 to 5. But I will confirm this. Actually, this may not, because I teach today and I teach a class tomorrow that's at the same time. We have to. I can't be in two separate. The exam gets scheduled at the same time, so this may. I'll let everyone know. Okay, so let's just treat the final exam as TBA. It'll either be the 16th or the 17th of June. Okay. The final exam, 35%. It's cumulative with respect to the chapters and lectures, but there will be a fairly substantial bias towards, probably something like 70% of the stuff will be post midterm. Since, I could do, a second midterm on the last day of class, which isn't really a midterm, it's an interim, and then have the final like the next day, but that's just... What's the word I'm looking for? Oh, yeah, stupid. So we won't do that. Instead, we'll just bias the final exam to be more focused on the later material. Okay, so there's four really short assignments. They are like literally a page here. So here's the deal. The exams are written. For the midterm and final, they consist of... We'll get in your hot little hands, possibly slightly sweaty, clammy hands. There's an evolutionary reason for that. you will get an exam booklet. Flip open the page, and on each of the pages, you will see a question at the top of the page, and then blank 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. Fill your answer in there. Right? With me so far? Good. Okay. There's actually a sample midterm, like last spring session's midterm is up online. So you can go take a look at that and see exactly what it looks like. The questions that I ask on the midterm and the final. On the final, there's also like a longer sort of open-ended question that you can just pontificate and go on for as much as you want. But the bulk of these questions are these short little, in the space of one page, give me your thoughts, your views, your ideas, what have you. The questions that I ask on the midterm and final, in that form, and the questions that I ask with respect to the assignments, come out of the same exam bank. Okay? Over the years, some of these questions have been exam questions, some have been assignment questions, back and forth, whatnot. They're the same format. So, if you think about this, if you're in an exam, right, and you maybe have to do 5 of these questions in, 80 minutes for the midterm, you've got 15 minutes of questions, sort of thing like that. If you can do the question in 15 minutes in an exam, if you want to, be lavish and take a half hour to do an assignment question, see where I'm going with this? Right? These aren't giant, must-go-to-the-library research for a week to find the answers to the questions. Okay? Between the stuff in your textbook, the stuff in the class, the lecture, and a little bit of thought, that's the answer. So, these are not research-based assignments. They really are very, very short. Okay, so each one is worth 5% of the total grade, due on the 17th and 26th of May, and the 7th and the, this is actually not correct. Hold on. I've got a feeling I've got the wrong little file here. This should be the... I think I'm a little bit off. Let me just check my calendar here. Okay. Yeah. sorry. That should be the 8th. I'll get this fixed. And that should be the 13th. Yeah, okay. That should be the 6th. Okay, well, this we're just going to stick as TBA because I honestly don't know. And then, yeah, sorry. We're off on a day here, 16th and 25th. There, I think I've got that right now. Okay. Right. So here we go. Okay. So 16th, 25th of May, 6th of June, 13th of June, and those are the assignments. Okay. Sorry about that. The paper is the 8th of June. Well, it's worth 25%. We'll talk about stuff like that. Just a minute. If you miss a midterm, that's because you are seriously ill. I need documentation on this. There is a medical emergency or death in the immediate family. There is a recognized religious event occurring. No fair claiming you're a modern age druid and you're hungover and it's spiritual because beer is a sacred drink of druidic system. I tried this when I was an undergrad. It didn't work, so, you know, it's not, okay. Anyhow, but if that's the case, get me the info that indicates that, and then I transfer the weight to the final exam. If you miss the final exam, that is out of my control. You must go to your home faculty, and you must explain to them why you were not able to write the final exam. If they think that you have a reasonable reason for this, and this date, I think this date actually is correct. If they think there's a reasonable reason for why you missed the exam, yes, that's correct. You will be granted a deferral. You will then write the deferred final exam on the 24th of June, 2011, at 2 p.m. Come by my office, and we'll get just straightened out with that. As I said, I've already pretty much covered this. The assignments, they're short, one page in space to answer the question. Really, same format as the exam questions. The one thing I forgot to mention was you can do this in a group of up to two people. So if you'd like to work with somebody else on this, you discuss, debate, work on it. You turn in the assignment together, so both of your names are on the assignment. You both get the same grade. Little caveat. Well, a couple of things. You don't have to be in a group. You can move in and out of a group. Right, you can be by yourself, you can find a group, you can decide the group isn't working out for it, you can leave the group, you can find another group, okay, you know, whatever, all right? I do not arbitrate group disputes, all right? I've got enough of that with my kids, okay? Well, she hit me, he just threw something. Work it out, okay? If you're not happy in your group, just get a little group divorce. Your assignment separate. But if you do decide to work on something by yourself, separately, then you work on it by yourself, okay? There's not that many of you. I think I've seen this assignment before. You're not in a group. I'm suspicious that these are similar. Yeah, okay, whatever. So, yeah, you can work in a group of two students. Okay. Look, technical stuff here. You need to get your assignment into me by the beginning of class, yada, yada, 10... Okay, I'm not actually entirely this much of a hard ass about this. A few years back, I just said, you know, get me assignments in, you know, whatever class, you know, during class. And I had a case where I was done, you know, teaching whatever for the day 10 minutes early or 15 minutes early. So it's just, okay, I can go. And, like, the student shows up, like, 1 minute before the end time of the class, by which point everyone's been gone for, like, 13 minutes. And I said he was late. It's like, but I was there before the class was over. Was there anyone in the room? Fine. So this is the technical thing, you know. Get it in at towards the beginning of class. Honestly, if I get it by, you know, if you're coming a few minutes late and you just, you know, you get it to me by the break halfway through the class, I'm going to be fine with that too. Okay, really? This is just sort of the technical stuff to keep people from, you know, trying to sneak in at the absolute last moment of class, and if I'm not here, then trying to check me down, and I have to assess whether they're really late, or if they... Okay, look, just don't be stupid, okay? Let's just go with that. You've got these massive evolved brains, okay? They're huge, right? You guys You're like university students. You're like the academic elite. You're like the best of, well, I don't know if you're the best of the best of the best, but you're at least the best of the best. Okay, so something to work for. But so just be reasonable about this, all right? You can give the assignment directly to me. If you can't, if you, hey, you know what? If you want to turn these things early, knock yourself out. That's terrific. You know, great. So, you know, either get it to me. If for whatever reason, you know, maybe you're turning in earlier, maybe you are late, or I don't know what, you can take it to the Psychology General Office. It's BSP, the Psych Wing, room 217. The very nice office staff will date stamp it and pop it in my mailbox. We've never lost one this way. They're open from 8 to 12, 1 to 4, Monday through Friday. Also, technical caveats, because I had one student who was stunningly irate that the office wasn't open on Sunday when he came in. I don't even know how I got into the building on Sunday, but still. Okay, so you can do that. You can thumbtack it to my bulletin board outside my office if you have no other sort of options there, but I will treat it as submitted whenever I actually get it, because I have no way of, there's no date stamp on it. I don't actually know when you really turned it in, okay? So that's not it. Please, 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 please. This is really for your protection. Please, please don't stick an assignment under my door. Weird shit happens, okay? About one in three terms, and I've never been able to explain this, about one in three terms, not every term, for every term I can figure, it's an intermittent schedule, okay? One in three terms, stuff just goes missing. Students, did you get it? I put it under your door. It's like, no. I don't know whether, like, technically cleaning staff is supposed to pick up anything that's on the floor and throw it away. I've been doing a little experiment in my office. You ever see my office? It's kind of a disaster. So I've been trying things, just leaving boxes and stuff on the floor, and they refuse to throw that stuff out. So I don't know if it's like every year and a half some new cleaning staff comes in and decides they're going to follow the letter of the law, finds an assignment that's tucked under the door or partially under the door or whatever, scoops it up and throws it out, or maybe they step on it and rip it and they go, oh, disguise that, so they throw it. I have no idea. I mean, it's possible the students are just lying to me. It's like, oh, yeah, I totally put it under your door. Did you get it? Oh, yeah. I don't think they're all lying to me. I had a few of them go off and swear an oath, you know, about it. So it's like, okay, that's a legally binding thing. So, all right. So I don't know. It doesn't happen all the time, but every now and then, things just don't get to me. And then it gets into a, well, I turned it in. Well, I don't have it. Well, I turned it in. Well, I don't have it. Do you have it back? No, I wrote it out by hand. So then you did a photocopy? No, I don't. So you have to do it over again. Well, I don't want to do it over again. I already did it. Okay, so please, just, and if you're, maybe you're worried, if I put it to the bulletin board, someone's going to take, who is going to take something that's stuck in my bulletin board? I've had that comment as well over the years. Is there a massive black market in Psychology 302 assignments? That, I mean, is it worth big bucks on eBay? I seriously doubt it, okay, you know. Anyways, give it to me, take it to the office, okay? Those are the best ways to do this. Here's the grading scheme. A few things, straight up. If you've had courses from me before, this will be old hat to you. I do not grade on a curve. There are a number of reasons why I do not grade on a curve. We'll get to those in a moment here. Some people said, well, wait a minute, the university guidelines say you should grade on a curve. No, the university guidelines are guidelines. That also says that professors are free to do pretty much whatever the heck they want with respect to this, as long as it's consistent and they have a rationale for it. I mean, I can't say something like your grade will be based entirely upon how much pink you wear. Okay, that's absurd. Although it would be interesting as a sort of behavior modification process. So here's why I don't grade on a curve. First off, statistically speaking, there's not enough of you. Okay, statistically, there's too few. I cannot fit a curve to, whatever, 18-odd people. Needs to be like probably at least 75 to 100 of you. Second, to fit a curve, normal Gaussian distribution assumes that you have a representative sample from the population. You guys are not a normal representative sample. Okay, and I mean that in a nice way. But you're doing this in spring session. Okay, that's unusual. Normally there's like 75 people in this class. There's like less than 20 of you. So there's something different going on here. All right. So statistically, curves don't fit. Second, if you want to get a high mark, right, I mean, I'm going to assume most people are looking for relatively high marks, okay? In a class this size, 17, 18 people, I can give like an A if it was fit to a curve. I'd also have to fail at least two of you. Yay, that sucks. Okay. Right? And so, I mean, I started out in zoology, and I don't know what, you know, a biology program's like nowadays here at this university, but when I started out in zoology, the zoology was very frequently, at least where I was, a stream for pre-med. And it got very competitive. So I was in a course where it was based on a curve, and there was like three A's that would, we didn't actually use A's then, but the equivalent of three high marks. And one student poisoned another one. Well, used a very extreme laxative, slipped it into the other student's coffee so that they would do poorly on an exam. Now, I mean, on the one hand, this is kind of funny as hell. To have med students, you know, pre-med students poisoning each other with laxatives. On the other hand, it's a serious issue. Okay, funny but serious, right? Okay, I mean that's wrong. Okay? You are not competing with anyone, right? The very fact that I'm letting you do assignments in groups. I mean, if we were on a curve, then you're competing with your own groupmate for grades, and then I mean, it's like the only person you're competing with is yourself, okay? If you all get A's, you all get A's. Score, okay? I don't have a problem with that. Next reason why I don't do this is this allows you to time manage better, okay? Having set cut points gives you a time managing ability. If you're on a curve, you really don't know how you're doing with your term work until the final exam comes in and the final grades are handed out. It's like, all right, I'm doing 85. My term work is 85%. What's that mean? Well, if everyone else is doing on average 85%, you've got, you know, like maybe a B minus or a C plus. You can't tell, okay? With this, you know, look, I mean, well, I'd like to think that this is going to be a stunningly valuable, significant course that will change the way you think about psychology and other aspects of life. This may simply be the last course you need to graduate. You may have an amazing job already lined up. All you need is really, like, I don't know, a B minus. If you've gone through the term work and you've done really well, you work really hard in term, you go, you know, based on my term work, I've actually acquired 60% of the total grades I could. I think I can pretty much not bother studying for the final, show up and just kind of drool a bit on the paper and probably score that last few percent I need. All right. Or maybe you're taking another course right now that actually is, you know, this may be an option for you. The other course is actually required for your major, your minor, whatever it is. That's what you need to put the additional time into. Okay, you can time manage, right? You can manage your lives, your adults. Okay? This gives you that ability. Last thing I want to say here is there's sometimes some questions about the A+. In the bizarre, I mean, this is like in a bizarro world, but in the bizarro way this was done, an A and an A+ both equals a grade of 4.0, which is stupid. In my humble opinion. But I'm going to say it's stupid. Because once this was done, yay those many years ago, the decision was, well, so then what's the difference between an A and an A+? It's like, an A+ is sort of a cherry on the sundae to represent students that are performing well beyond the level of the course. So for this level of course, that would mean you're essentially operating like a master student. I'm not kidding. This is really the way it came down. So what this really means is for something like an intro psych course, you shouldn't be any A+s at all because nobody can actually assess whether or not someone's operating in a, you know, a multiple choice exam format as like a fourth year honors student. It's a stupid policy. Regardless, this is what we've got. So my solution for this is basically to say if you can get over 94% in the course, I'll score you an A+. That means you're functioning at a very high level. But basically anything over 89, you know, gives you that 4.0. Okay? So it's the balance. Now, I mean, if you do follow a strict curve, then yes, I would probably in a class this size have to give, well, like 0.68 of an A plus out to somebody. I'd probably round that to one. So, I mean, there'd be at least one guarantee. But again, the flip side, I have to fail somebody. So, you know, these are the checks and balances. Anyhow, okay, so there's the grading breakdown. I'll post, well, you know, I give everything back to you, well, except the final exam. I keep that. I have to, under university regs, I have to hang on to one sample of your work, so I hang on to the final exam. But you'll get your assignments back, you'll get your midterm back, you'll get your paper back. Okay? I'll also put the grades up as a PDF via a link on the website. I put them up by ID. If there is anybody that does not want me putting their ID up on the website, which is publicly accessible, let me know in writing in the next, you know, couple weeks. I had a case once where there was a woman who was separated from her husband, and he was essentially stalking her, and he had a restraining order on him, but she was concerned because his soon-to-be-divorced husband, he did know her ID number. You know, if you're stalking, you're a bit obsessive-compulsive to begin with. So her concern was that he could obsessively-compulsively go through all the grade listings on websites. This has changed a little bit with Moodle now. You have to, it's linked into yours personally, but it's not the way I do things. But her concern was that he could find her schedule, reconstruct it, and be waiting for her. So it was like, no problem, easy peasy. We just simply gave her an artificial ID number for the term, and then she went off to the registrar's office and got a new one. Okay, so if anyone's got some sort of problem with that, you know, something significant, if it's a case where you've been, you know, writing your ID number, you know, for on the bathroom walls for a good time, please contact 0163947. Then that's your problem. Okay, appealing grades. More information is on the syllabus about this. I call them an answer justification. I do my best to grade fairly, but maybe I missed something. Maybe I didn't get where you were coming from. Maybe I just couldn't read what you wrote, whatever. Okay. You can come and talk to me about it, but I ask you to, I mean, if it's just a calculation error or something, that's straightforward. That's easy. You're miscounting something. It's like, oh, dude, okay, yeah. Apparently my math sucks. I ask you to give me a little written, what I call answer justification. I do this really because I don't think I'm that intimidating, but there is a power differential dynamic here. And sometimes, you know, hey, psychology shows that if you are dealing with superior, you may not put your best sort of ideas forward when speaking. But if you have a chance to write things out in advance, you know, when there's no sort of pressure there, standing in front of me trying to explain your rationale, you can write it all down. You can reference things from the textbook, the notes. If you brought something in from a different course, well, I was thinking about it from something that was said in the social psychology course. Like, oh, okay, well, I didn't understand that. All right, sure, let's see. Okay, then give me that. So keep your original, give it a photocopy, highlight the relevant sections on it that pertain to your argument, explain in your justification why you should get the higher marks, and get that to me. I take a look at that stuff at the end of the term. Just a note: any info, any stuff dealing with term work has to be really addressed before the final exam there. So get that stuff into me for the final exam. Just a note on this: I will not lower grades. Okay. I mean, like, unless I miscalculated something, it's like, really, I counted this up and gave you like 47, but it should have been 37. Well, okay. Of course, no one's going to come and tell me that, right? You know, I never hear about that stuff. I really think you overgraded me on this. Really? Yes. Seriously? Yes. I don't deserve it. It's like, okay, fine. No. It never happens. But I know some people say, well, you can do a reevaluation of it, but your mark might go down. That's just a bullshit way of getting students not to come talk to the professor. Okay? I'd rather have people talk to me about stuff. Hey, I mean, your grade may not go up, but it won't go down. So there's that. But I do raise grades. So I mean, it's like, yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think about it that way. Oh, I see what you're saying. What? Oh, that's what the word is that you wrote here. Okay. All right. So, anyways. Prerequisites. Psycho 223, 233, 2. I'm not really sure why 2. Oh, no, yeah, 241, right. 141 is a status course. So 241, 258, 267, 275, 281, any two of those. Okay? You got any two of those, you're shiny. You can be in this course. Cheating, plagiarism, yeah. Look, the detailed breakdown on the course syllabus. The details are all in the university course calendar, or university calendar, which you should have read. It falls under part of the code of student behavior. But the short form of this is, thou shalt not represent another's work on an assignment, exam, paper as his or her own. Thou shalt not submit material completed or in progress for another course, for this course, without written approval. So if you're taking two courses, you've got stunning overlap between paper topics, you can't recycle the same paper twice. Thou must utilize appropriate APA citation format and referencing for your term paper, and thou absolutely shalt not cheat on exams, either by looking at other students, by writing things on the brim underside of your ball cap, by, I don't know, you know what, if you actually get a tattoo explaining, say, Hamilton's rule of kin-selected altruism, okay. If you're willing to go through that amount of pain to have that permanently etched into your flesh, thereby also demonstrating your good genes, your fitness to withstand pain, and possibly thereby attract members of the opposite sex, all right. I'm good with that. Now, if you get that tattooed on your butt, it's going to be kind of embarrassing in exams for you, so at least do it someplace that you can easily see. All right. You know what? I didn't actually say anything about the paper, really, except that it should be amazing. Paper topics are up on the website. You'll find them later, but I can't remember all the topics, but like one of them is take a look at Sir Mix-a-Lot's lyrics for, you know the song, Baby Got Back. And link it into evolutionary psychology. There's a variety of stuff up there. Take a peek at those topics, and you don't need to start them, right away. You might want to get a little bit into the course content before doing so, but take a peek at them, think about them a little bit, and as we go on, think about what might interest you. Okay, so there is that. Let us any questions about stuff? No questions. Okay.
Actually,
there's a question. No.
Are you doing a podcast?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I am. It's recording right over here. Sorry, I'll pop the if you didn't get the website, I'll pop that back up at the break, and you can jot the website info down. But yeah, I'm recording the podcast right now. Okay, so as you've already figured out, of course, in evolutionary psychology. So evolutionary psychology is it's relatively. Getting a bit older now, but it's moderately new. In terms of its instantiation, actual format as a sort of codified element in psychology, this really goes back into the early 90s. People were taking and applying evolutionary concepts, Darwinian concepts to psychology, well before this, certainly going back into the 20th century. Actually, if you go into the 19th century, people like William James adopted an evolutionary or Darwinian approach to his psychology as well. But it really sort of, evolutionary interpretations kind of fell out of fashion with the rise of behaviorism in the early 19th century. But in terms of it sort of being codified in this way, early 1990s. Now, evolutionary psychology is not a sub-discipline in the way that, say, behavioral or learning or clinical or cognitive or abnormal or social or neuro are sort of, fall under the umbrella of psychology or developmental for that matter. Evolutionary psychology is a overarching theoretical approach that can be applied to greater or lesser degrees to any of these subdisciplines. So you will get evolutionary developmental psychology. People will take evolutionary psychology and apply it to developmental, or actually linguistics, psycholinguistics, often brings in a lot of evolution, social cultural, over about the last 10 years, 8 years, we've seen a real increase in the amount of evolutionary psych making its way into social psychology. Not all social psychology, but some. So that's why we've got this extremely weird prerequisite structure, since, you know, you can pretty much apply this as a theoretical approach to any of the subs of psychology, then, you know, as long as you got a couple of them there, great. We're fine. So, I mean, as we go, think about how you can apply this to the things in psychology that you're actually really, really interested in. What evolutionary psychology does is it's a science. It's a scientific approach to this. And it looks at the study of human behavior, brain, mind, you know. I mean, once you guys figure out what the heck we're actually studying in psychology, let me know. Because, right, you know, you get three psychologists together and say, what's psychology actually about? And it's going to end, well, it's going to end up like, you know, the sale of the white iPhone in China. You heard about that? Oh, yeah. People got into it. They got a white iPhone. When iPhone 4 went on sale in China, well, I guess yesterday, today, however you want to count the days, with the world spinning. And a massive brawl erupted. Store employees injured the store, pretty much trashed, had to lock down, closed for the rest of the day. Crazy desire for the white iPhone. It's okay. So, anyways, but I mean, you know, you don't quite get that with psychologists, but I mean, you know, brain, behavior, mind, something else, I don't know, whatever. But that's what we do with evolutionary psychology. We take evolutionary theory and try to interpret and predict human behavior patterns with respect to this. Now, there's a couple of, you know, interesting things that come out of this. And, you know, we always talk about the idea that scientists are impartial. Scientists are non-biased, right? Scientists would like to be the Mr. Spocks of the world, if you will. Rational, coldly logic, analytic. But that's not really true. Scientists are people. They bring their own particular backgrounds and biases and beliefs to it. Now, a very interesting one with respect to evolutionary psychology is what you think about humans, where they sort of fit in the grand scheme of things. Now, from a biological perspective, humans are animals. My son, he's 6, gets this. My daughter, who's just turning 4 in a couple of days, is like, no, we're not. It's like, yes, we are. No, we're not. It's like, okay. So we've got a whole bunch of, we got a small pack of dogs and one very neurotic cat. And so it's like, okay, so do you have legs? Yes. Do the dogs have legs? Yes. Do you have a nose? Yes. Does the dogs have a nose? Yes. Do you have teeth? Yes. Yes. We go through all this. So are the dogs animals? Yes. Are you an animal? No. I'm a people. Let's go through this again. She's fine. We're getting there. Anyways, so biologically speaking, we are animals, no question. Remember the animal kingdom, we're primates. Okay. The question, though, is, as, you know, sort of to take George Orwell's Animal Farm, you know, all animals are created equal, but some are more equal than others. Is that the case? Are we special animals? And if we are, what is it that makes us special? And you get a range. I mean, some people that work in evolutionary psychology take a very, we are just members of the animal kingdom, you know, chordata, mammalia, primates, boom, that's apes, that's us. We're members of the great apes, you know. Got a bigger brain and stuff, but phylogenetically, here we go. Other people take a somewhat different perspective on us. And we see this in very interesting areas. Like, for example, the debate between gradual versus recent development of particular characteristics and traits. Let me give you an example. Language. So, think about this. How far back do you think human or proto-human, I mean hominid, you know, Homo erectus, Homo habilis, Australopithecus, okay, I mean, how far back do you think some form of language existed? Okay. Neanderthals. So Neanderthals go back 300,000 odd years ago, up to about 30,000 odd years ago, give or take, a little bit of change. Yep, so they probably, they probably have some form of language, despite earlier ideas that no, they didn't, but probably do. Yeah, the Neanderthals are actually very interesting. We'll talk about them some more later. Okay, so, you know, maybe at least 300,000 years, and I mean, us modern Homo sapiens are going back maybe, 200,000 years plus change, so probably somewhere there. Anyone want to go beyond that? Before that was Homo erectus going back to maybe 1.6 million years ago. Before that, Homo habilis going back to maybe 3.5 million years ago. Before that, the Australopithecines graciles, which we came from, we think, going back maybe, 4.5, 5 million. So how far back do we want to pick? Anyone vote for, over a million years? So our predecessor, Homo genus? Okay. Well, there's not necessarily any right or wrong answer to this. And it's very hard. I mean, until someone invents a time machine, it's going to be very difficult to really nail it down. But there are very interesting things that can be done with this. So here's some of the reasoning on this. Language requires metacognitive representational thought. To be able to utilize language, you have to take some abstract symbols, words, and be able to associate them with something else, and also be able to take what somebody else is using as words, sounds, and associate them with something. This is very complicated. Okay, so it's meta-representational thought. You don't have to just think about stuff for yourself, but you have to be able to think what somebody else is thinking about when they're talking to you. Okay? So, meta-representational thought. And the question is, how far back does this go? Now, language doesn't fossilize. What kind of stuff does stick around? Things like art, for example. Now, if you can do art also requires meta-representational thought. If you can say, I've taken this stone and carved it to look like whatever, a pony. Really, as ugly as pony I've ever seen. But sure, okay, fine. We can pretend it's, ever seen kids' paintings? It's like, I painted you something. It's like, oh, that's great. What is it? It's you. Oh, I see it now. Oh, my God, I'm ugly. That's horrifying. Okay, so anyways. Kids thinking it's you, whatever. Okay. That's meta-representational thought. So art, to be able to get somebody else, you take the vision you have in your head of something and you're going to translate it into something somebody else is going to understand it. That requires meta-representational thought. So here's the idea. Okay, so back going through fossil record, we've got examples of art that go back maybe 60, 70,000 years, or at least for a very long time. We had things that were maybe going back to 60, 70,000 years ago. But as more and more archaeology, paleoarchaeology goes on, this keeps getting pushed back further and further. Probably got art going back 90,000 years now. So for a long time, though, people that took the approach, some people said, well, language is very recent. Homo sapiens, us, our ancestors, even though evolved maybe 200,000 years ago, our ancestors probably didn't develop language until maybe 70, 80,000 years ago. Because look, that's the first time we start finding examples of art. Bone flutes, little stone carvings, paintings, whatnot, ornamentation, 60, 70,000 years ago. Well, if you've got the capacity to do meta-representational thought, you would have the capacity to do language. And if you had the capacity to do meta-representational thought, you would obviously make art. We don't see any examples of art from before 60, 70,000 years ago. So, based on this, we can conclude that language didn't exist more than maybe 80, 85,000 years back. In other words, only Homo sapiens had language. Okay. Here's the deal on this. Like I said, archaeology is finding evidence of art going back even further. And more recently, just released last year, art has been abstract. Well, artwork in terms of painting scallop shells to keep the color, the orange color. The scallop shells, if you've ever seen these, they have an orange color while they're alive. They lose that afterwards. But some have been found that have been painted to keep this sort of orangey-red color and drilled so that they can be worn as necklaces. No other reason to drill out a shell, okay, but drill so you can run a cord through it and wear these as necklaces. Now, interesting, these go back about 50,000 years. Okay, so wait a minute, that's even less than 60,000 years you talked about, Snyder. What's up with that? Here's the thing, these come from Neanderthal. So we come back to Neanderthals. These come from Neanderthal sites. Now, Neanderthals and Homo sapiens diverged way back when. Should we assume that both Neanderthals and Homo sapiens sapiens, incidentally, Neanderthals are now being called Homo sapiens Neanderthalus, and we're Homo sapiens sapiens. Should we assume that they independently both evolved the capacity for meta-representational thought? It's possible. Or should we assume that the predecessor species that they both derived from already had meta-representational thought? If they already had meta-representational thought, they'd have the capacity for language. Now, it wouldn't necessarily be as complex, perhaps, as modern language, but they would at least have the capacity for language. Why don't we find art? I don't know. Maybe the form of artwork that Homo erectus did was all bonsai trees. That's not going to fossilize very much. I have no idea, right? Maybe they only did things with ephemeral reeds, or I don't know. But let's look at it this way. Ever tried to make a tool? Ever tried to make something to do something? Okay? That takes meta-representational thought. If you can hold it, I need to do this task, and I need to make this thing to do that task. You've got meta-representation going on up there. Well, our ancestor species have been making tools for at least 3.5 million years. But it's not art. Art requires meta-representational. So does tool making. Chimpanzees can make tools. I mean, you know, it's not like an industrial bandsaw or something, right? I mean, you don't want to really want to give a chimpanzee an industrial bandsaw. You know? I mean, after the excited hooting and jumping around, I mean, they're going to be churning out like machine guns, and then pretty much it will be, you know, ape apocalypse. Forget about zombies. It's all over. And thus, we have the beginnings of the new Planet of the Apes sequencing. Yeah. No. Chimpanzees don't naturally use language, okay? But everyone in psychology has heard about the famous chimps that have been taught a certain amount. I mean, Kanzi, for example, certain amount of language. Okay, look. They have the capacity for this. They have the capacity for simple tool use. Well, I mean, it's relatively complicated, but I mean, still compared to the stuff we do, it's pretty simple. All right? Now, I mean, if we give that same sort of ability to Homo habilis, handyman, habilis, I mean, the handyman, tool-making ancestors, if we grant them meta-representational thought, they probably also could have had some form of simple language. Can I prove it? No, I can't. But science works on parsimonious explanations. And so this is a fairly parsimonious explanation. Some people don't like it, though. And it probably gets back to, are we special? Okay? And, I mean, everyone likes to feel special. Everyone likes to feel unique. Okay? So start looking. What is it that separates humans from all the other animals out there? Tool use. Well, no, not that. Okay. Fire. Well, okay, sure, fire, you know, right, okay. You know, microwaves. Yeah, okay, well, we're gonna get a little silly, but language. But language is a form of communication, really. And there's some pretty complicated communication. And recent work in psychology that's been working with birdsong communication, showing that for the songbirds, things like, oh, even the humble little chickadee, they have to learn their songs. They don't come biologically pre-programmed with the song. If baby chickadee males have to learn their songs, which admittedly are not language in the sense that a linguist would talk about language. I mean, a chickadee can't communicate totally new stuff. I mean, their communication is, you know, stuff like, hey, I'm hot, come have sex with me, let's make beautiful little eggs, you know, that sort of thing. But, I mean, so they can't communicate things like, look over there, there's an ornithologist observing us, let's go poop on his nose. You know, they can't give that kind of stuff in their song. But it's still a pretty complex form of communication, and it has to be learned. An animal with a brain the size of the tip of my finger there, capable of doing this kind of learning of complex communication, you got to sort of start wondering about this. So how special do you think humans are? Some people think humans are very special. Okay, and as such, and I mean, it may not even be a sort of conscious reasoning about this. Right? I said scientists are people too. We do not always evaluate well where our assumptions come from. Okay. So, anyways, just keep that in mind as we go through the course here. Now, there is something that makes, well, not specifically us as humans, but mammals a little bit unusual. And that's mammalian social organization. We're the only order of species that the mothers must rear the young because of the milk production. Okay? Male mammals cannot keep baby mammals alive. Okay, yeah, I know. Formula, sure, so fine. We can sort of do this now, but leaving aside the last, about 85 years of time here, which is nothing from an evolutionary perspective, mammals, the mothers are very, very, very important. If you don't have females able to raise the young, you don't have that species anymore. It vanishes. Okay? Now, because of this, we get a very interesting social organization. Mothers are always with their offspring, at least for some period of time. The fathers of the offspring generally, they may be around the offspring, but they're generally not particularly involved in the raising of the young. And if you look at the vast majority of mammalian species, male involvement goes from basically contribution of sperm and nothing else up to, well, us, where there's some fairly active involvement there. The vast majority of mammals, the contribution is fairly minimal. But mother-offspring association, that's a given. The other thing we get in a number of species of mammals, especially the more social mammals, including things like the social carnivores, many of the primates, are maternal cross-generational links and bonds. So grandmother, mother, offspring, or mother and her sisters, so the aunts of the offspring. So we'll get these complex female connections for raising of young. What we've got here is a limiting resource. So the limiting factor in terms of the number of individuals and species you're going to have in mammals are females. That makes females very, very, very important, right? Males are cheap and expendable. I really can't stress this enough. Guys, we're easily replaced, I think, is the answer, statement I'm going for here. From a biological perspective, right? Okay. So what we get in most mammals is some form of polygyny, where a male fights with other males or does some sort of fight, could be dance fight, you know, could be actual antler smash and fight, could be, you know, winner take all, five card draw, whatever Give baboons a deck of cards, and pretty soon they're addicted to gambling. Okay. Okay. In most mammals, what we get is polygyny, where you've got a male that has a harem of females. It will mate with multiple females. Okay, and that male will mate guard the various females in his little group.
You occasionally get some sort of monogamous mammals. It's much less common. Gibbons kind of do this. Beavers sort of do this. Humans, to a greater or lesser degree, sometimes kind of sort of pull this off every now and then. Until they get divorced, or they just cheat. But anyway, but you get the idea. It's not typical. I mean, if you think about things like ungulates, I mean, like deer, you know, I mean, hey, you know, anyone see the horrific movie Bambi 2? No? You're lucky you don't have kids. Okay? All I can say, right? Bambi, a classic, right? You know, mom gets shot, run, Bambi, she's dead, Bambi takes off, makes his way in the world, raised by, you know, taught by skunks and small rabbits. I mean, you know, frankly, from Harlow's study with the terry cloth monkey mom, we should think that Bambi is going to be terrifically messed up. Regardless, Bambi 2 involves Bambi's son's mom, apparently also vanishing. I'm not exactly entirely sure how. I think hunters get her. So, I mean, assuming that Bambi hooks up with Faline, I think Faline gets blown away and turned into, like, venison sausage, and now Bambi is left to raise his son. Bambi would not raise his son. I'm sorry. He just wouldn't do this. Male deer is just like, I'm a male deer. I got a bunch of females. I am so hot. And I've got about 3 years left to live before I die. That really sucks. So I'm going to have a lot of sex with all the female deers I can find. And then I'm just going to die. But I can't have meta-representational thoughts, so I don't think about those sorts of things. No, this is the deal. If you become a dominant male deer, you got about 2-3 years left before the stresses, physiological, the physical conflict and fighting over the females eventually wears you down and you die of a parasitic infection. Just some winter you don't make it through it. Oh, it's sad. Wolves eat you, something like that. Okay, it's not glamorous, but there we have it. So in most mammals, we have a polygynous system. Now, in most birds, we actually have more of a monogamous system. In fact, in some bird species, the female picks the male, mates with the male, lays the eggs, and then goes, bye! I'm just going out for a bit. And it's like, okay, you're not coming back, are you? No! She takes off and leaves the male with the task of raising all the young. That doesn't work in mammals. Can't do it. Okay? So, right. This makes humans a bit unusual. The very fact that we have such, the potential for such high male investment in young makes us a little bit different. Not unique. Not unique. There are other mammals that do this. But it's a little bit different. It leads to a rather different social organization. So just keep that sort of in the back of your heads there. I'm not going to, you know, on exam questions, I'm not going to ask you to, like, redraw this or remember this, but I just sort of want to contextualize some of the stuff that's happening here. Now, somewhere between, and, you know, there's a lot of debate about this, but somewhere between 10 to 5 million years ago, probably closer to 5 million years ago, bipedalism of our ancestors gets going, so we start moving from an arboreal that is up in the trees, arboreal brachiating existence, down into some form of bipedal locomotion. And it doesn't just start, it's like, hey, I'm walking upright. I mean, it's a gradual. This is the thing with evolution that you gotta wrap your noodle around, is that it's really, really slow, okay? It doesn't just, boom, happen. Ever heard of punctuated equilibrium? Concept by Stephen Jay Gould says, you know, species remain more or less constant for long periods of time, and then suddenly they evolve into something new. Now, by suddenly, Gould's talking about tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years. So evolutionary biologists think in a really weird way about time. Time, so much time must pass. If you're like, you know, say a subatomic particle nuclear physicist, theoretical physicist, they've got a weird sense of time as well, right? I mean, they're thinking about, like, what happened in the first 30,000th of a second of the universe? So much stuff, really, in a 30,000th of a second? It's like, okay. Different ends of the spectrum, right? Okay, so things take a long time. Okay, so probably somewhere close to 5 million years ago, bipedalism kind of starts going here. About 3.8 million years ago, we'll get the earliest Australopithecine afarensis. fossils that have been discovered. Now, look, this is the thing. As you do more and more paleoanthropology, you know, you find stuff, and the dates get pushed back a little bit. Okay, so we're, you know, these are sort of ballpark figures here. Around 2.5 million years ago, we'll talk about this. We'll talk about this in a while. But about 2.5 million years ago, the brain size of our ancestors starts to expand. For whatever reason, it starts to get bigger. And within a couple hundred thousand years of that, we start having tool use. Okay, so the actual, not just like picking up a rock and going, hey, I found a rock, I can smash a nut with it, but actually taking a rock and turning it into a slightly different kind of rock. I mean, it's not like the Flintstones where they're making cars out of rocks and logs, but I mean, you know, stone called hand axes and whatnot, so modifying things. Probably there was a lot of this going on based upon, oh, say, work with primatology of chimpanzees over the last 30 years. Chimpanzees make a lot of tools out of wood. So these would, of course, not fossilize. They're just going to decay. All right? So probably there is some form of tool use similar to the kinds of things being done by modern chimpanzees. And this is the thing to remember as well. Modern chimpanzees branched off from the line that led to us quite a ways back, probably 5-6 odd million years ago. Probably further, further back than that. So, you know, we talk about chimpanzees being our closest living relative, but I mean, they're actually pretty distant when you get right down to it. Okay, so probably they were using something, some sort of wooden tools before this to break open beehives to get honey or smash smash benzoyl nuts or something like that. Okay, it's about 2.5 million years ago, stone tools. About 1.8 million years ago, Homo erectus walks out of Africa for the first time, starts expanding the range of our ancestors. Then around 1.6 million, we get an increase in the types of stone tools. They're better tools. They're more elaborate, more carefully worked. You can do more with it. They're just better tools. Evidence for regular consumption of meat shows up in this period. So from about 1.5 to million years ago, we've got pretty strong evidence that our ancestors were regularly, presumably hunting. It's unlikely they were probably scavengers as well, undoubtedly. But it's highly unlikely that they were getting this amount of meat just through scavenging food. So we have this controlled use of fire about 800,000 years ago, and again, probably a bit earlier than this, and probably, you know, use of uncontrolled fire before this, we would expect, that is opportunistically finding, you know, some lightning strike that sets something on fire and getting some fire and using it until it you know, burns itself out or something like that. So probably goes back before this. 200,000 years ago, another major advance in tool use. Also about roughly 200,000 years ago, origins of modern Homo sapiens, again, probably going back a bit before. Art 70 to 90,000 years ago, in terms of painting, figures, carvings, instruments, beadwork, these sorts of things. Now, I had this discussion with someone who was a raw foodist a while back, and her argument was that eating raw foods is evolutionary. I said, really? And she said, well, yes, because clearly we've only been cooking foods for, you know, maybe the last 8,000 years or so since the agricultural revolution. And I said, well, we've got evidence of the use of controlled use of fire and meat eating for, you know, going back almost a million years. It's like, well, I'm not talking about meat. I'm talking about vegetables, you know, grains, plant material. Oh, okay. So that's only the last 8 to 10,000 years. Well, obviously, because that's when we started growing grains and vegetables and having crops. So, okay. We've got archaeological evidence of grindstones going back 25 to 27 thousand years. So stones for grinding grain.
were we actually planting grain and farming grain 27, 30,000 years ago? No. No, that probably is around 10,000 years back. But there's wild grains all over the place. Our human ancestors were very smart. They found the grains. They harvested the grains. You know, nomadically, they wander through the area. They come back every year where the grains are growing. Come back at a particular time, harvest the grains, and they grind them. Now, the only thing you do with ground grains is make flour. The only thing you do with flour... Anyone ever try to eat just flour? Right? You got to make bread, right? There's really, or you've got to, like, you know, batter some fish with it and fry them up. Not much else you do with flour, okay? So we were cooking. We were cooking vegetable products a long time back. Does it fossilize? No. But grinding stones, I mean, you find those. Like I said, these have been found dated to 27,000 years ago, which again means undoubtedly they were there, that we've been using these longer than this. These are just the ones that have been found. Okay. So, but sure enough, you know, the so-called agricultural revolution, about 10,000 years back in the Fertile Crescent, this is where people sort of stopped having a hunter-gatherer, migratory, nomadic existence and started settling down for the raising of crops and animal herding. And about 6,000 years ago, 6 to 8,000 years ago, 7,000 years ago, we get the first cities. Within about 500 years of having the first cities, we have the first walls going up around cities. Now, by cities, you know, I'm not talking like Edmonton, New York. I'm talking like maybe, you know, 1 to 4,000 people is what we're talking about here, which, given the time, is pretty darn big. And as I said, within about 500-odd years of these people coming together in larger settlements, they start putting 6 to 8 foot walls up around the cities. Want to take a stab at what those, let's say, an 8 foot wall is good for? What do you need to keep out?
People.
Yep, that would be it. You don't need an 8 foot wall to keep a hyena or something out, or a crocodile. You need it to keep other people out. So that's what's happening. So we'll talk about warfare later in the course here, but this goes back quite a while as well. More recently, Industrial Revolution, 150, 200 years ago. You know, are we in the midst of a technological revolution, if you want to give, you know, nifty-sounding name to it, microchip revolution or something, okay. Cell phone revolution. So this is sort of a really quick breakdown in things here. And again, you got to sort of wrap your head around the long time scale of things. Evolution works on generations. Our generations are fairly long, right? 15, 20 odd years between generations. That kind of drags things out. There's a reason why geneticists work with things like bacteria. Oh, generations of 3.5 hours. Or fruit flies, you know, generations of a few weeks, right? You know, you want to do a longitudinal study of human genetics? Good luck getting a grant. Yes, we'll finally be finished our study in 690 years. We're not going to publish until then. Denied. Okay, you're not getting that grant. Just to give you a few sort of pictures here, to give you a sense of what things might have looked like. Artist conceptions down below, but actual fossil finds of skulls up top. So Australopithecine from 2.7 million years ago. Brain size of about 650 cubic centimeters. So this is a later... This one here is from a later Australopithecine, so larger there. Homo habilis, excuse me, next. Brain size about 800 cubic centimeters. And then next to Homo, this one's Homo erectus with a brain size about 900, so actually fairly early Homo erectus. And then I didn't bother putting up a Homo sapiens sapien because I figure you know what your own skulls look like and brain sizes here, but Neanderthalus. So Homo sapiens Neanderthalus, about 1,400 cubic centimeters, a bit larger than us. But, you know, if you look at the skull there, whoa, that's a pretty massive brow ridge. That's a pretty big jaw. Clearly, they must have looked totally different from us. Probably not that much, actually. I mean, I know people that look sort of like this. It's like, you know. Neanderthals would have looked different from modern humans in terms of their overall body structure. Their legs were a bit shorter. They probably were not as good, a little more bow-legged, much more barrel-chested, so bigger thoracic cavity. Bones were proportionally larger, so muscle mass would have been higher. The larger attachment points for muscle, so they would have been stronger. But here's an interesting one. I just want you to think about this quickly. Have you ever seen depictions of Neanderthal? Let's try this. What do you think Neanderthals, in terms of, say, skin color and hair color, what do you think they would have been?
Probably Caucasian.
In the northern latitudes. The vast majority of depictions of Neanderthals are they're kind of darker skinned, flat noses, dark hair. So they're giving them this very sort of almost bestial appearance. They're making them look, and you get into all kinds of interesting issues in terms of racism with this. I mean, many of these depictions start out in the late 19th century, so out of northern Europe, like English and German and French researchers and artists doing the depictions. So they're making them look sort of darker skinned, so like the colonial peoples, colonized, all right? So you've got a certain amount of racism. It still carries over in the depictions. But yeah, these guys moved up north. They moved into northern climates. What do people from northern climates look like today? I mean, your Scandinavians, your Swedes, they're pale, they're blonde, they're red-haired. Right? Northern Neanderthals were probably pale-skinned, blonde, pale brown hair, red hair. These are likely what they really would have looked like. But our representation of it doesn't do that. And again, the idea, well, they went extinct. They must have been bestial. They must not have been intelligent. They must have had flaws. You mentioned the issue of the hyoid bone with language. So for years, it's suggested that Neanderthals couldn't use language. Therefore, they're more animalistic. They're being revised. So there's some very interesting issues with respect to that. If we could bring a Neanderthal back, and there's people that are talking about doing this through genetic engineering, they would probably not look terribly out of place in the modern world. Clean them up, stick them in a suit, give them a haircut, a few tats, you know, look like a guy that's been at the gym a heck of a lot. Yeah.
There's some researchers that posit that we have some of their genetics.
Exactly. Actually, a sort of breakthrough or landmark study released about 10 months ago suggests that if you are of European, Caucasian and or Middle Eastern and Asian extraction, you may have up to 4% of your genome that is Neanderthalus. If you're African, of African extraction, no. So it seems that at some point in the last maybe 90 or 100,000 years, as those of our ancestors that left Africa, once again, interbred with some of the Neanderthals, and so we have a certain amount of the Neanderthalus genome in us, those of us that are of Caucasian or Eastern extraction. So yes, there's a very interesting, and that get back, and once you bring that in, you start going, well, okay, look, if we're able to interbreed, then again, you know, speciation, I mean, this is one of the things that defines a species. A species, we define a species biologically as either for cultural or physiological reasons, you cannot interbreed and produce viable offspring. That's what makes a species. Okay. Well, we were doing it. So Neanderthal, probably very, very similar to us. So again, how special are we? Gets back to the question. All right, why don't we take a 10-minute break at this point,
and I know there's not a lot to do around this side of campus, you know, this engineering building here, but why don't we take 10, come on back, and we'll carry on from here.